We'll definitely get a full done.
Well, yeah. No, I'm talking about whether we can get a third one.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see what we can do. But let's jump right in.
Yes,
shall we?
Let's.
Everybody, welcome to the Scary Dad Podcast, episode 31, dropping on May 15th of 2017. Your boy Scotty, your boy Scary Dad over here talking about Stephen King.
Stephen King. You can't talk about horror literature for sure without mentioning Stephen King.
Absolutely. And what triggered this episode for me is one of the shows, one of the podcasts that I listen to regularly is the one called Boys and Ghouls. And Boys and Ghouls, I've probably talked about them in the past, but it's a guy and a girl, and they talk about a subject pretty in depth, whether it's a movie or a book or a genre or a trope of some sort, you know, crazy clowns or this or that. And on a couple of occasions, they've done a full in-depth on a Stephen King. Let's call it a Stephen King oeuvre. So they've done Carrie. So they talk about the book, they talk about the movie, they talk about the history of the book, the plot, the production of the movie, the actors, the actresses, the legacy. We're not going to go into that sort of detail on this, but it is. We're kind of into the summer. It's starting to get hot. It's summer reading time, it's pool time, and I recently just picked up Christine again. Hit up a estate sale not too long ago, and they had a whole big stack of old Stephen King hardcover books.
Nice. I found a few that way too.
And that was one of them, and I read Christine, I think, when I was in high school, so that was going to be like 25 years ago. And I remember, like, there's scenes in that story that I just remember from a long time ago.
Stephen King's ability to immerse you in it and just paint that picture perfectly, it sticks with you for a long time.
Absolutely. We also have It coming up, the remake, the movie they just dropped the trailer for. So we're going to... I reached out to Scott and was like, hey, how many Stephen King books have you read? And just like everybody on planet Earth, he said a lot of them.
You know what's weird is, have you ever met someone that despised Stephen King?
I have, and we'll talk about that in a second. Because I find it almost, I find it somewhat humorous.
I know, me too. I got a coo in about that.
But let's get into the history segment. It's not very long, so let's just cut right through it, because I want to get to the meat of this.
Okay.
This might be a little bit shorter episode than we normally have, but every time I say that, it turns into a longer one.
Yeah.
But just looking at the material. But I want to get past the history segment. It's not very long, but it is kind of cool. And somehow or another, serendipitous, it's relatable. So on this date, May 15th of 1252, Pope Innocent VI issues a papal bull, Ad Extirpanda, which authorizes the torture of heretics in the medieval Inquisition. So we just did our torture episode two episodes ago. If you want to know kind of what this guy was authorizing, go hit up episode, what was it, 29?
Yes, yeah. We actually speak about the heretic's fork, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely.
The tools there.
We also recently talked about executions. That would have been episode 27. On this date in 1536, Anne Boleyn stands trial and is condemned to death. On this date in 1718, Mr. James Puckle patents the first machine gun.
Changed the face of war.
Mm-hmm. Not necessarily evil. Well, it's got its share. It's seen its share. They don't have a whole lot of lakes to cement shoes anybody into. But on this date in 1905, Las Vegas was founded. Las Vegas plays a key role in the Stephen King novel The Stand.
Yes. And Vegas itself is just... I'm sure you've been.
I've been many, many
my
times.
My favorite place to see a concert is Las Vegas. I love going to Vegas for concerts. If you've never been to Vegas, you got to do it at least once in your life, for sure. It's an experience.
Oh, this date in 1928, Mickey Mouse premieres in not Steamboat Willie, but Plain Crazy, was his first cartoon. Pretty crazy there. trying to see something like 1886 to 1940. So, in episode 30, we said on 5/8 of 1886, the first Coca-Cola was sold. Fast forward about 60 or about 57 years. This date, May 15th of 1940, McDonald's opens its first restaurant in San Bernardino. So you can guarantee your ass they sold a Coke.
McDonald's, that's just a, you know, it's kind of a nightmare when you think about it to a certain extent. You know?
I go back and forth on McDonald's. I really, really wonder what a McDonald's burger tasted like in 1940.
Yeah, if it tasted like cardboard or not.
I bet you it tasted wonderful.
It probably did.
I mean,
this mass production all of a sudden takes away from that.
Yeah.
Know?
I was starving the other day. I drove through the 99-cent cheeseburger. I shouldn't have done it, but I did it anyway. It's like that big around.
Every time I go to McDonald's, every time I stop in, I look at the menu, and there's absolutely nothing that I want.
I mean, I have that little touch of nostalgia, right? So when I was a little kid, we'd go to McDonald's, and it was kind of like a treat. It, you know, Happy Meals and stuff. It wasn't, we didn't eat it all the time, for certain. My mom was much more of a bologna and cheese type mom. She wasn't big on the Mickey D's.
Right.
But I remember my grandmother used to call it Mac's House, and we'd go to McDonald's and get the Happy Meal or whatever, but the cheeseburger has shrunk since I was a kid getting a cheeseburger and a Happy Meal. Now, I'm a pretty big dude, but it's like the same size as the bottom of an aerosol can.
Yeah.
There's nothing to it. It's just like, jeez.
Their fries are still good. I still enjoy their fries.
The fries are all right. I'll give you the fries.
The burgers, though, are just... my kids even prefer a homemade burger.
I've also noticed, and it's probably just because of all the fillers and preservatives, I've noticed that's a lot about fast food, but McDonald's especially. I can go home and I can get a ball of ground meat. I can flatten it, spice it, throw it on the grill, and I'm talking a big burger. And you eat it, and maybe like an hour and a half, 2 hours later, you're hungry again because your body absorbs all those nutrients.
Yeah.
I'll eat a crap burger from McDonald's, I'll get full, and I'll stay full for hours.
Yeah.
Like, there is no nutrient.
It takes longer to digest that thing, too, man, just to get it through. Remember my grandmother used to call homemade hamburgers meatball sandwiches. I used to laugh my ass off every time she'd say that.
If they're made right, that's what it should be.
She's like, you want a meatball sandwich? It's like, yeah, grandma.
Full of burger. Man, that really just, like I said, every time I say, but then we start going on stuff. So, we've talked in the past, we'll do an episode in the future once you get boned up on your reading, but have you read a whole lot of Neil Gaiman?
Not a whole lot.
Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett wrote a novel together, and it's called Good Omens, and it's a comedy about the end of the world, and it's kind of like a comedy of errors. So basically it's the biblical apocalypse, but things are not going the way that they're supposed to go. Without going into great detail, but for example, the Antichrist is born. The Antichrist is supposed to be born to a certain witch, but they're switched at the hospital, and he's raised by a good family. So he doesn't have that kind of evil... he's not taught in the ways of evil.
Right.
And... so they send the Hellhound, his companion, and this thing, it's a demon, and it will come and it will be by his side and it will take whatever form he names it. And he's supposed to have been trained to turn it into some giant city-destroying beast, but instead he sees it and he calls it Puppy. And this monstrous demon thing just slurp. Turns into a little puppy, and that's what it becomes. So it's an actual, it's a little dog with the mind of a puppy that's just his little buddy, right? So it's that kind of stuff. But anyway, they talk about the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And so you've got pestilence, death, famine, and war. And Pestilence is a pharmaceutical CEO. And Famine is a fast food CEO. And instead of people wasting away or whatever, he creates giant, wonderful-to-eat meals that have, like, negative caloric value. So you're starving to death and getting fat at the same time. And that's the trick. And every time I look at a fast food burger, I think of Famine from Good Omens.
I like that. The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse has always fascinated me.
Mm-hmm.
Just their depiction through culture, through different times and everything.
You should read it. Good
the
Omens.
Idea of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse is pretty scary.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're riding the winds right now.
Yeah.
But we don't want to talk about that. That's more scary than a Stephen King novel.
We're going to do an episode on the apocalypse itself.
The biblical apocalypse?
Yeah.
I think we could.
Because I was getting to it with my son the other day. My son wanted to read the Bible just to see what it's all about and everything. And we got into that part. And, yeah. That'd be fun.
I'll preview this. Man, when I was a kid, so probably like 9 or 10 years old, this church that I went to, small town Portland, Texas, right outside of Corpus Christi, we had a pastor that was, normally he was pretty, the church we went to was never really very much fire and brimstone. It was always pretty positive. Mm-hmm. It was God is love, not God is vengeance. But he did this whole long, I'm going to say like maybe 3 weeks, maybe a month, so maybe 4 weeks, on the book of Revelation. And he had this tapestry. It was like this big curtain hung up across the back that somebody had drawn. And it looked like a picture out of a comic book. But left to right was basically a mural of Revelations. So it had the big dragon.
Oh, wow.
And it had the 666 in the wrists. Mm-hmm. Like, and I remember being a kid just staring at that thing, just fascinated and terrified. Just like, oh my God. Because when grown-ups tell you something's on its way, you believe them.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I guess I don't need to go to college. This is stupid.
We could even tie Book of Revelations into Constantine and also Preacher.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it'll be a fun episode. We'll plan on that.
We'll get into that. All right, so notable births this year in 1856. L. Frank Baum, who wrote The Wizard of Oz.
Okay.
Not
horror.
Not many notable deaths. It's, like I said, kind of a slow news day. But
Wizard of Oz scared me when I was a kid. Those monkeys, they just scared the hell out
of me. I think the monkeys scared everybody.
And then whenever they had the remake, the Wiz, starring Diana Ross and Michael Jackson, that one was scary.
That was scary. Did you ever see Return to Oz with Feruza Balk?
No, I haven't.
That came out, I'm going to say, like maybe 1987, 1986, 87. It was a Disney movie. And it was billed as like Wizard of Oz Part 2. Dorothy returns to Oz, whatever. Google it. It was terrifying. I saw it in the theater. And it's probably one of the scarier movies I've ever seen as far as just, in general, like, what the hell? Shock value? You had these reavers that were like rollerblade people. So they had, they remember those workout machines that
yeah.
you have a ball, like you have a wheel on an axle, and then you like do like
yeah.
kind of rolling push-ups. Yeah. They had these attached to their arms. So they had this wheel that their arms just ended into this wheel. And then they had rollerblades on their feet, and they rolled. And when they'd stand up and they'd hit people with that wheel, there was this witch that was chasing Dorothy, and she had a hall full of heads. And all of them were awake and screaming, and she'd walk into the thing, and she'd pull off one head and put it away, and then pick up another one. And that was how she disguised herself. Scary as hell.
It sounds like it.
It was a scary movie. Disney's kind of put that one into the vault. You can find it if you look, but it's scary as hell.
Well, especially if you walk into it expecting Wizard of Oz.
A Disney Wizard of Oz.
Right.
Not so much. it was a good scary. All right. So, like I said, we're getting to summer reading, getting to Stephen King. A couple of things. Like I said, the podcast is telling me about how the last one that they did was on The Shining.
Okay.
So I just recently, I didn't have a paperback version of The Shining anymore. I read it years ago, but I'm going to reread it. And I picked up Christine, and which is not one of those that you say that you've read, but just that's where I've got a bookmark in it right now.
I've got a copy of it, just haven't read it yet.
So you mentioned, have you ever met somebody who just generally hates Stephen King? And the answer is yes, but tell your story first.
I'm at a con, and I'm at Bernie Wrightson's table, hanging out, talking to him and his wife. And this guy walks up, and he's looking at some of the stuff that Bernie has on his table. And as you know, Bernie's done a lot of work with Stephen King. And he had a couple of Stephen King books up there. And this guy proceeds to rant about how he cannot stand Stephen King and his mass-produced crap. How, you know, all his books are just... How did he put it? They have no soul. It's just, you can tell that he just on and on and on. And I'm looking at him, I'm like, do you realize that you're talking to a friend of Stephen King who's also contributed to some of these books that you're berating right now? And the guy just had no clue. And finally, I told him, I said, you know, this book right here, Bernie did all the artwork for it. And he kind of crawfished back a little bit. But yeah, I'd never met somebody that so vehemently hated Stephen King before.
There was quite a bit of Stephen King hate. I mean, he was wrecked by the critics, but he sold.
Right.
So there's that. But you can't really... I mean, he's got such a massive body of work.
Yeah, there's something here that you're going to like.
I mean, even if you don't like horror at all, there's going to be... I mean, he's got romance stories, not like... a lot of them, but he's got science fiction, he's got fantasy, he's got other stuff, you know, he kind of runs the gamut of genre. Even he was kind of afraid of being pigeonholed as just a horror writer, which I find odd, because when you go to the horror section of a bookstore, it's relatively small. There's not a whole lot of pure horror writers. Yeah. And most of the ones that have succeeded and maintained in that genre have done really well for themselves. But, man, my dad used to have two or three books floating around the back of his car when I was growing up. He always had a book. You know, I remember Stephen King books, The Dead Zone, the Christine, whatever, floating around on the floorboard of his car as we were driving around places. But what Stephen King brings to the table in most cases is something that a lot of people just don't really realize. Now, he'll tell you about it. He wrote a book called On Writing, where he explains exactly what he does and how he does it. And for him, it's a clarity and a simplicity of language. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is he's talking about, he attempts to tell the story in as few words as he can possibly use to get the idea across, and then to build the world around it. So whenever you do read Stephen King, like you said, it's immersive. It brings you in. It draws you in because you don't have to think too hard about what you're reading. The words themselves are so clean, clear, and simply put together that it's like eye candy. It just kind of draws you in and lets you enter this world.
Yeah, and your own imagination takes over.
And so to the critics of that you want it to be somehow more complex, somehow more wordy, somehow have loftier goals. Well, there's a billion other writers that you can read, but if you're trying to pick up a scary book that's just a fun read that's interesting, that might get your blood up a little bit, that's what you're after. And he's the master. He's also better than a lot of other people at being lofty than they are when they're trying to be.
Yeah,
because he can just in a simple turn of phrase, he can get the point across really, really well, very efficiently. So I want to talk about some of our favorites. I highlighted the ones I've read. You circled the ones that you've read.
Mm-hmm.
If we start talking about these, we'll be here all night. So I can just start at the beginning.
Okay. I'm going to go through and just check off my favorite ones, the ones that I enjoy the most.
Well, I'm going to start with my favorite one, and it's one that you haven't read, but it's Salem's Lot.
Yes.
in a world of sparkling vampires and Vampire Diaries and every attempt to throw back vampires to where they should be is rebuffed by sparkling vampires, and Salem's Lot is perhaps the only and the last scary vampire book I think that will probably ever be. It's vampires. It's straight up vampires. There's no question about it. There's mm-hmm. no ambiguity to it at all. But these are demonic, evil vampires, and they're slowly taking over a town while they sleep.
Right.
They're spreading like a cancer, and they're straight up evil. And some of the scenes in this book are just... My favorite book that I've read probably 5 times, and I take it to my wife who reads books, like, she'll if she got into Stephen King, she'd be through this whole list in probably like 2 weeks. No lie. She'd pull down It in like 4 days. But she doesn't like scary things. And I handed her Salem's Lot, and she couldn't make it through 30 pages.
Really?
She handed it back. She said, I just cannot handle this.
So this isn't like Vampire Lestat, where you got to learn his background and see how he gets along with other people and stuff like that.
It's not told from the perspective of the vampires.
Right.
It's very frightening, and it's flawed. It's got its moments where you're like, but it's a second book. He was like 27 years old, so what you gonna do?
Right.
But it is phenomenal, and you haven't read that one, but that's my gift to you. Highly recommended. Read it as soon as you can. We'll do a whole episode on
okay.
it. It's great. So the real beginning to our conversation would be The Shining.
Yes. Love the book. Love the movie. Just the Shining is such a hardcore psychological horror movie. It just it hits you right there. It's hard to explain. Just my fascination with The Shining. It was. This shit could really happen. It was one of those books where, you know, this book is so real. You immerse yourself into The Shining, and mm-hmm. it affects you.
Absolutely. I saw the Kubrick movie before I read the book. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it many times since. And I think that The Shining is probably in the top 5 of most everybody's list of best horror movies ever.
Right.
Scariest, creepiest. It's just got an atmosphere and a way about it.
It's a cerebral horror movie.
That just gets under your skin. And so then, you know, I saw that movie, read the book, and then saw the made-for-TV movie that came out in like 1997. And that the made-for-TV movie actually follows the book more closely mm-hmm. than does the Kubrick movie. But all three of them together just create this world of story that just draws you in.
And it's a book. That's one book that can give you nightmares.
You want to explore this hotel.
Yeah.
You want to go...
more about the background. You want to learn more about what's happening with it.
Right.
Why things are going on. You know, who these people are.
And funny little addendum to The Shining. And I've got a feeler out on eBay right now. So when the TV movie came out in 1997, TV Guide... the cover, you know, is Stephen King, The Shining. Stephen King wrote a prequel, not a prequel, but a prelude, a prologue, sorry, to The Shining. So it would be a prologue, a story, and then an epilogue. But his publisher cut the prologue because to keep it under 500 words or 500 pages, they could sell it for $1 less, and that meant a whole lot more sales.
Yeah.
But the prologue does go back into the history. There's a Tumblr that you can go on Tumblr and look it up, and it's got the whole text, but it was printed in this TV guide. And the reason I'm going to buy this TV guide on eBay is because Bernie Wrightson did the cover for that TV guide. So it's one of those, we've got to get one of those.
No doubt. definitely one I will look into.
So you marked your favorites. What was your next favorite?
My absolute favorite Stephen King book is would have to be Skeleton Crew.
Oh yeah.
His collections of short stories I kind of got into and really enjoyed a lot. And Skeleton Crew was, to me, is the better of them. After that, I would say Different Seasons. Different Seasons was more novellas, though. Skeleton Crew was actually some really good short stories that were not long at all, but really hit home. You know, and just the visuals, his ability to paint these pictures, and just, you know, the one story that catches me the most from Skeleton Crew is what is it called? Survival. I think it's called Surviving or something like that. But it's about a guy who gets in a plane wreck while he's smuggling drugs and gets stuck on a deserted island by himself. And it's about him surviving. He's stuck on a deserted island with two keys of heroin, and that's it. And it's a rocky place. There's no vegetation. It's not like he can eat coconuts. He essentially has to try to kill, you know, seagulls and catch crabs that are like floating around in different little pools and stuff. And he's also a surgeon who lost his license because of his drug use. And he breaks his ankle at one point. And he sees that it's going to get infected. It's going to get gangrene. And to save himself, he knows he has to amputate. And just the descriptiveness just the of his story is amazing. And by the end of the story, he's pretty much a quadriplegic with no limbs left. You know, still trying to survive. Using heroin as a way to anesthetize himself to perform these surgeries, and you know he starts realizing, you know what, I can eat my calf, you know I can eat my thigh, and it's a pretty intense story, and just all those stories in that book they just take you.
I've read Skeleton Crew. I don't remember that one. I don't know if that's one of those ones that in maybe a certain edition that I got or whatever, but
that was a really crazy one. And just some of the more psychological ones, like the one about the milkman. It's not a very long story. It doesn't. You don't immediately realize what the milkman is doing, but he's essentially a serial killer, and it's told from his perspective and everything. And it's just his ability to paint pictures is really really obvious in that book, because he goes through so many different genres. Because he also does science fiction, he does horror, he does just all across the gambit. And it's that's definitely one of my favorite ones.
Well, up here, one of the ones that I didn't highlight it because it's in one of the collections. It was in Different Seasons. And it's called The Long Walk.
Yeah.
And that's one of those that always stuck in my mind. And I think we talked about it on a different episode before. But the story behind The Long Walk is that it's very much like The Hunger Games, only it's all boys. And in some post-apocalyptic future, there's a lottery. And they draw your name. And if they draw your name, then you line up. And they have like maybe 100 boys, and they all start off at a line, and then they blow the whistle and you walk, and you have to keep a pace of 4 miles an hour, and you walk, and if you fall behind 4 miles an hour, the whistle blows at you. If you fall down, if you can't get up, then they shoot you, and the walk continues until there's one left.
Yeah.
And I remember, because I was in high school reading this, I was a teenager. I was the age of the kids in the book. And they describe it as, you know, punched your ticket. Like, oh, you know, he got his ticket punched early on because he twisted his ankle and he couldn't keep up. So every time I hear the word, you know, punch the ticket, that's what I visualize, is somebody on the back of the Humvee shooting the kid in the back of the head.
Oh, man. That's a rough visual there.
So, yeah, but, I mean, Different Seasons had The Long Walk, it had Rage, it had Stand By Me.
At Pupil.
Which was At Pupil, and, well, Stand By Me was the body.
Yeah.
So.
And At Pupil, actually, that book, that's one of the things that kind of got me fascinated with the whole Nazi regime. Just is his ability to just paint that picture of what the Nazis did, and his boy's fascination with it. Just, I wanted to learn more about it. Mm-hmm. It's just how macabre they actually got. Which, the At Pupil book is far better than the movie. The movie, to me, just could not do it justice with the way he was able to do it, paint the pictures with the story. But,
well, it's the way that minds can get twisted. Mm-hmm. That's the idea of it.
And this boy's fascination just went to beyond just, you know,
have you ever known anybody curiosity. Have you ever known anybody that was just kind of overly interested in something like Nazism? Or not yeah. Nazism as a social movement, but as, like, the helmets and the imagery and all that stuff?
It gets to
the
point of it being a curiosity to it being an obsession, I guess. You know, it's... You know, just to want to learn about something is one thing, but when you become so fervently obsessed with it that it kind of takes over, yeah, I've seen people like that before.
See, I know a lot of people, I wouldn't say specific people, but I know a lot of people that are Civil War buffs, or not Civil War buffs, but World War II buffs, are quite taken, like, they have quite a an interest in and a affinity for the Wehrmacht. Their equipment, their tactics, their uniforms, their imagery. Now, to be fair, it was all designed by the government to look cool. Yeah. I mean, it was designed to draw you in and make you want to be a part of it, but that was a lot of propaganda as well. Yeah. But like I said in one of the episodes recently, like, I've always been tangentially interested in, like, World War I, World War II. I want to know what happened. I want to know why it happened. I want to know... where it happened and who was affected. But I've never been specifically interested in the Nazis, the Nazi culture,
yeah.
You know, all of that stuff. And I find it bizarre that people are. Like, I can see being like, oh, as a tactician, if I'm playing a video game, I'd want to play the Nazis for the first 3 years because I'd win. But then I'd get my ass beat in the last two, right?
Right.
But I don't want to be... I'm not interested in, like I am in Superman, I guess.
Yeah. To me, it was more of a thing just wanting to see how far they would go and why a human being, like we said before, would go against everything that, you know, you should be for.
All your human decency.
Just totally out of the window. And just how far they were actually willing to go is just, it's scary, you know, and it's something that shouldn't be whitewashed. You should know that there are evil-ass people like that that have existed and could possibly exist again.
See, and I always get to this spot where this is by no means any kind of defense of the Nazis or Nazi tactics, but I always have this feeling of if history or the government or anybody's telling you something was bad to an extreme, the truth is probably less extreme,
yeah.
But there's an agenda there. Because you see it now with people with all of their Islam hating and then the blacks and the whites fighting in different areas of the country or whatever. Everything was just fine a month ago or 5 years ago or whatever, but now all of a sudden this rage is boiling over,
yeah,
and it's being poked by the media, by the government,
right.
by just like writers and stuff.
I bring up all the time, how long have Muslim countries been fighting the way they're fighting right now? Thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, thousands of years. Only up to the last
25, 30
years is where we've noticed all of a sudden we have an issue with it. You know, we want to change everything, their way of thinking. But this is a way of thinking that we've allowed to exist for thousands of years.
Well, also, that's just, they're sitting on a bunch of money.
Yeah.
That's it. And it's just like G.I. Joe. When Cobra was defeated, they brought up Serpentor. You have to have an enemy that's just a little bit more scary and just a little bit worse than the previous one. It's a propaganda machine.
Yeah, it often
so,
is.
Like I said, not in any defense of the Nazis, but I think if the cultural idea that they were bad to, you know, 100 points to this side, probably dial it back about 25, and then maybe two more,
because
right. Maybe it wasn't as bad as we're told, but they don't want people thinking that way, because it goes down a bad path.
Yeah, and on the other side of the coin, on the other side, the same things are probably being said about us,
mm-hmm.
to their people, you know, lots of exaggerations and propaganda. You know, it's a two-way street. I mean, it happens.
Absolutely.
You gotta try to be able to see through it if you can.
All right, moving on. You have Pet Sematary marked?
Yes, I do.
That's one of your favorites, really?
Yes, I love Pet Sematary a lot. It the book more than the movie. To me, the book just goes above and beyond where the movie went, as far as, you know, just once again immersing you into the story.
Absolutely. Pet Sematary, I would have to say, is probably one of my least favorites.
You didn't like it?
I enjoyed it for what it was, but it was so dark.
Yeah, it's a very dark
book. I think it's probably among his bleakest works, in that it, even looking down the line of all of them, at least all of them have at least some sort of, not if not positive, at least not negative ending.
Yeah.
If the main character dies stopping the end of the world, as he does in the Dead Zone,
he still stopped the end of the world.
He still stopped the end of the world. In Pet Sematary, there's just,
it just ends bad.
Everybody just is, it's just bad. And they say that he wrote that as a, like, he disavowed the book. He wrote it as like in a bad mood. But why is it that you like it so much?
I enjoy just the style of writing and everything. It's a book that affects you in a certain way. It really, really emotionally, it was a strong book.
Yeah. Just thinking about it now, with having small children, I can't even imagine putting myself through reading that again.
It's a nightmare.
Absolutely.
The book is a nightmare on paper.
Little trivia. In the 1997... made-for-TV movie The Shining. Mm-hmm. Remember in the Kubrick, whenever he's in the bar and it's all closed up, there's nobody there, but the bartender starts serving him alcohol, yeah, and there's no alcohol on site, but it's there. In the TV movie, he actually has that same vision, but there's a band playing. And Stephen King himself plays the band leader. And the band leader's name is Gage Creed.
Really?
Yeah.
That's pretty wild.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is.
He has all those little throwbacks to his other stories.
Yeah, he connects a lot of stuff like that.
I don't want to go into Pet Sematary too much. Pet Sematary wrecked me for a while. I read that when I was in high school.
We'll jump right into something more interesting, which is Cycle of the Werewolf, which... On the literary side, the book isn't the best Stephen King book, but the way I look at it is an accompaniment to the movie, which I love the movie Silver Bullet so much. It's one of my favorites by far. Just Gary Busey in that damn movie is just classic.
No, it's Corey Haim.
Corey Haim, yeah, he plays the young kid in the wheelchair. It's a really good book. I like how it's told from the perspective of the sister. It's a fun read. It's not a real involved book. Very short chapters.
Mm-hmm.
Good illustrations, of course, by Bernie Wrightson. But adding a movie to it also, I think they did a good job with that movie.
Well, and we'll get into this after we cut through a few more.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the ones you have checked because I didn't recheck. Have you ever read It?
Yeah, but it's been a long time. I've only read it once.
It's long. Nobody should expect you to have to read it more than that. You saw the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
I honestly think that It is probably one of his magnum opuses. Probably one of his best works.
It just want to hit home with a lot of people. I mean, it's a great, great movie. I saw a shirt the other day, almost bought a Pennywise, where it's Pennywise saying, "Aren't you going to say hello?"
He just has this way of tapping in to
your fears,
your emotions, however it may be. He's just got this way about him. And are you're familiar with the author Louis L'Amour?
Yeah,
wrote a bunch of westerns.
Yeah,
Louis L'Amour wrote a tremendous amount of books, and a lot of times he'd travel to the places he was writing about. And he would sit there and actually write in these places to be able to absorb the atmosphere and the ideas of things. And Stephen King, in one of the forewords to one of his books, is talking about how people always ask him where he gets his ideas. And he says, "I don't know, I just think about what..." He says, "And you can't ask that." He's like, if Louis L'Amour was to sit next to a lake, he might imagine the Native Americans coming there to water their horse. He says, I think about the thing that may have died in the lake years ago that the Native Americans fear. It's just perspective. It's not a matter of right or wrong, good, better, or best. It's just the way we see it. And a good writer, he is somewhat humble for somebody who's so successful. A writer who's telling the truth talks about what he sees. So a lot of the criticism for Stephen King about being a hack, you know, so you've got The Shining, The Demon Hotel, and then you know, Cujo, The Demon Dog, and then Christine, The Demon Car, and then It, The Demon Clown.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it's kind of a one-shot, you know, one-shot guy. But in reality, he just, that's what he sees.
Yeah.
So, and all of them taken individually are their own story. If you do what Stephen King did and write the Dark Tower series to re-come all around and tie everything back together, then you're sort of acting like that critic that ties all his books together the same thing. But I'm looking forward to It.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what they do with the remake. They're going to do a good job with it. By far.
So moving on.
Well, Misery is one that you haven't read.
I haven't read. I've seen the movie.
You've seen the movie. The movie follows the book very well, except, of course, just like with all books that turn into movies, the book itself goes into a little more detail, more background and stuff. Mm-hmm. You learn more about the character, and it's a pretty dark book at times. The cool thing about that book is it can be almost high-spirited occasionally, but then all of a sudden it takes a really, really dark twist.
Honestly, I think I actually have read Misery.
And, you know, in the book, you realize just how psychotic Annie Wilkes is. I mean, she is a crazy bitch. And,
now that we're talking about it, I have read the book.
Okay.
I have read Misery.
And it just shows the two sides of her personality. You know, one, she's just a good old fun-loving country girl with a pig named Misery. And on the other side, she is a truly psychotic woman that is sick and twisted in the way mm-hmm. she wants to do things. I mean, in the book, when she hobbles him in the book, it is so much more intense than the movie itself. You actually wince when you read about it.
Yeah, and well, that's what made me remember that I have seen that. Because honestly, in my mind, because I didn't... I read the book after I saw the movie. But Paul Sheldon, I didn't see him, the actor. I can't think of his name.
Not Louis Dreyfus.
I want to think.
Is it Richard Dreyfus?
No, it's not Richard Dreyfus. I want to say Gene Hackman, but it's not him.
No, it's not Gene Hackman.
Anyway, he was the guy from The Godfather.
Yeah.
We'll think of it in a second. I saw her. I didn't see him. In the book, I saw a different. And so that's why I keep thinking of, like, not him getting his legs broken, right. not him laying in the bed and watching her go crazy.
Well, in the book, she actually cuts his foot off instead of just breaking it.
I mean, she hit it with a hammer.
Yeah,
to start.
Right,
and
right.
then
yeah, it's when he kills her in the book itself. It's a lot more detailed and graphic, and it just it. I enjoyed the book a lot more than the movie. The movie was good though. What's her name? Kathy Bates did an awesome job playing Annie Wilkes. She's a great actress.
She is. I think that movie made her career.
Oh yeah, definitely. Let's see what we got next. You want to talk Needful Things?
I'm talking about Needful Things. Needful Things was one of those that I normally do not... I don't normally like... I do like atmospheric. I do not like writing that is, for lack of a better word, unclear. You'll have some writers, especially some upper echelon... artistic, in air quotes, writers that will intentionally obfuscate what they're saying in order to make it seem dreamlike or outside of reality or high-minded.
They want you to finish the thought.
Cormac McCarthy is one of those where he uses a whole bunch of incomplete sentences and run-ons and strange little asides instead of a straightforward narrative, that it's supposed to create some kind of a picture in your head, but it, for me, it just doesn't work.
Right.
And I always end up being like, what, what? And I'll go back and I'll reread all of the words that are on the page, and I'm still left with an incomplete picture.
Yeah.
And he did that in Needful Things, but he did it to great effect. So in Needful Things, sort of similar to In Salem's Lot, the guy shows up in town. He's opening the antique store. It's called Needful Things, and the antique store is full of basically your heart's desire. So you go in, and it's anything you ever wanted. So for us, it would be an Action Comics number one right. for $5,000. And you're like, that's a $1 million comic. And he knows what he's got, but he'll explain to you why it's only $5,000. But he also knows that you want it so bad. So you go clear out your bank account, you buy the Action Comics number one, and you go home, and you're just in love with it, and you're looking at it, and it's the pinnacle of comic book ownership for a comic book collector. And he has this kind of dreamlike language that he uses that pulls you straight in and makes you, like, a lot of the artifacts in the book are things that I don't really care about, but, like, there's a character, she collects, like, candy glass, like Tiffany glass, and he's, like, these little figurines that she has, and she finds this one, and she's just in love with it, and it's like, man, I want some candy glass now. And one, she buys a chunk, like a splinter from the cross. Is it the cross, or... Oh, it's either the cross or Noah's Ark, but I think it's Noah's Ark, because then he dreams, and then he's feeling the boat roll under him. Like, he's on the boat.
Right.
He's feeling the reality of being on Noah's Ark and stuff. Stuff like that. And it's just so... It gets into your head, but it also gets into your dreams.
Yeah.
Then when everything starts turning bad, you knew it the whole time. Don't buy
don't
that.
Take it. Yeah, don't fall for it.
Because at the end, you end up getting into a fight. That Action Comics number one. You end up getting into a fight with your wife because that $5,000... you need it for your kid's medicine, and now your kid's dying, and you argue with your wife, the fight turns violent, you end up killing her, you wake up out of reality, and it's not an Action Comics number one, it's a DC Comics Presents from 1988, and it's worth a quarter at best.
Right.
And you've ruined your life over it. And it was... still sticks in my head. Like, it was a great story. I really enjoyed it. They made a really shitty movie about it. But the book was awesome.
Okay, that's what we want to have to check out, man. It does sound neat. What else we got?
Well, let's see. Desperation and the Regulators. That was an interesting experiment.
Were those two tied together, or?
Sort of.
Okay.
So
yeah, I see right here.
One of them is Stephen King, and one of them is Richard Bachman. Mm-hmm. And they have similar elements, but they're not the same story, but the characters are named the same. So it's as if two writers wrote two different stories using the same characters with the same personalities and put them in two different universes.
Right. And for those unaware, Richard Bachman is a pseudonym used by Stephen King.
Right. Stephen King got famous when he wrote Carrie. He went from complete obscurity to massive fame, like almost overnight. And a lot of his critics were calling him a hack, saying that he's a one-trick pony. He's a one-hit wonder. Then he came out with Salem's Lot, and it was another bestseller. And followed that up with The Shining, which, you know, The Shining, the book came out in 77. The Kubrick movie came out in 1980 or 81. Mm-hmm. So just short time turnaround since I think they filmed the movie for 2 years.
Yeah.
Stephen King wondered if his critics were correct. And maybe he was a hack. Maybe he was just lucky. So he started submitting manuscripts under the pseudonym Richard Bachman. And he got a few through, but he got published, and Richard Bachman was becoming popular as well. And either an editor or a critic recognized that the styles were the same and outed him. Like, I think this guy's actually Stephen King writing under a different name. And that then he's used a pseudonym from time to time ever since. Yeah. Whenever he wants to write something that's not in his normal game. So I think that was there was one. It's not here. It's called the Bachman books that he wrote. There was a whole bunch of his short stories that he wrote under Richard Bachman. Rage and Road Work.
Oh, Bachman books in 1985. Right here under Other.
Oh, there we go. And good old Creepshow.
Creepshow, how can you forget those tales, man?
Another one. I want to get that edition of Creepshow, the comic book, the Bernie.
Yeah.
Illustrated.
That would be a good one to get a hold of.
I believe that's kind of a good primer. I think, what is this? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18. There's 55 books and a whole bunch of collaborations, compilations.
Compilations, yeah.
Screenplays, everything else. We're gonna put links to some of these in the notes.
Some of our favorite ones. We'll go ahead
to go to Amazon, and you can just download them to your Kindle, which really helps us out. Even if you're paying a dollar or two for it, you know, we get like a quarter or something. It helps us out. Helps us buy stickers. But that's a little primer on Stephen King. We're gonna get into more detail. You felt us wanting to get into more detail on just about all of these. So we'll do every now and then.
There's a meta-episode every once in a while where we go into one of the books. And probably bring up some other authors, too. Some other horror writers.
Absolutely. We need to talk about Neil Gaiman.
Yeah.
Neil Gaiman, my favorite writer. Tons of books. Tons of comics. American Gods actually premiered last week. The premiere episode. Phenomenal.
Okay.
Good stuff. Don't need to have read the book to enjoy the show. It's really good.
And we'll bring up some Clive Barker, my favorite one.
Oh yeah,
he was stretching the comics and everything else. Also, he
tell us your favorite writer. We can do a profile on them. Maybe read a book or two. I don't know. Just let us know.
Yeah, and reach out to us definitely. Let us know what you think. Let us know what you want us to talk about. Comments, questions, just shoot them our way.
And. Sort of like last week, this week, the episode drops on the 15th, Monday.
Ides of May.
Which means yesterday, Scott was at Comicpalooza all day.
And I'm more out right now trying to get some rest.
Meeting and greeting. And we can't talk about Comicpalooza because it hasn't happened yet, but we're talking about it now as if it happened yesterday because it did, because we're wizards. So stay tuned. We'll do a couple little episodes, little metas on Comicpalooza and some of the other stuff that's been going on in town.
Yeah.
A lot of fun things coming up.
Got some fun interviews coming your way with a few folks, and definitely got more content to bring you guys.
So, that's episode 31.
It's a wrap. We're in the can.
On our way to episode 98.
We're getting there. Don't worry.
Stay scary, guys.
Later.
To the sacred place. ain't a dream. I can't escape. Smolens and fangs, the picking up.